From Caspary Auditorium at the Rockefeller Institute in New York City, CBS Radio presents The Great Challenge. This is the last of seven special programs that have brought world leaders together to consider urgent problems that face the nation in a rapidly changing world. Today, this CBS News Symposium will consider the question, what beliefs sustain the free world? And now here is the moderator of The Great Challenge, CBS News correspondent Howard K. Smith.
In past programs in this series, we have discussed the challenge to us in this, the second half of the 20th century, in many fields. Science, education, economics, human relations, government institutions, foreign policy. Today, in the final program in the series, we come to the field that is basic, the challenge to us in the realm of ideas. We would like to define the Western cause. What do we believe in? Are our values the right ones to meet the challenge of the times? I would suggest to you that our subject today is not only basic, it is also topical. In his study of history, Mr. Toynbee makes the point that the original Western community, and still a characteristic one, is France. France, while we speak here today, is in a state of profound turmoil. There is no economic crisis. French economy is amazingly healthy. There is a political crisis only in external symptoms. At base, France is suffering from a moral crisis, and it is one in which we all, to some degree, share. So in a sense, the effort here today to clarify our basic values and beliefs will not be a theoretical discussion, it will be a commentary on the meaning of the news. I would like now to introduce our guests. Next to me here, Professor Arnold Toynbee, former Director of Studies at the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London, the author of the monumental work, A Study of History, Professor Reinhold Niebuhr, the well-known author and Vice President of the Union Theological Seminary, and Dr. Charles Frankel, author, professor of philosophy at Columbia University, and a critic of Professor Toynbee and Dr. Niebuhr. Dr. Niebuhr, I would like to ask you to start first and to answer our basic question, what are the beliefs that sustain the Western world?
Mr. Smith, could I go back into history a little bit, perhaps too far into history, and say the thing that distinguished Western culture, or Western civilization, from the beginning was a component of Hebraic religion and Greek philosophy and science. This is, I think, what gave Western civilization its distinction. Now, from the Hebraic religion, we learned one thing, the value of this life on this earth. Secondly, the Hebraic religion, the biblical religion, gave us a sense of the dignity, the uniqueness of the person. This is, I think, one of the most distinctive marks of Western civilization. Confucian humanism doesn't know it. The mysticism of the Orient doesn't know it. That this unique, ludicrous, incongruous individual has some worth. This is the root of Western individualism on the spiritual level. And then, of course, the idea of a transcendent judgment on all these things. Now, we Christians are liable to be too complacent about this third idea, that there's a justice beyond our justice, there's an ultimate judgment. This ought to have provided a self-criticism for the whole of Western culture, but didn't, because it's possible for religious people to worship God as a source of a transcendent value, and then promptly identify their value with the divine. This is a source of fanaticism. And so there was not Western civilization as we knew it for many, many centuries, because it was a monolithic Christian civilization. What we call Western culture, I think, began in the 16th, 17th, and 18th century, where these absolutely unified concepts, theological, metaphysical, and scientific, were challenged. So that we have religiously and culturally what we call pluralism, that is, not a unified view, but different perspectives upon the problems. And then we got, in the 17th century and in 18th century France, secularism, which is also part of the total picture of Western life. Now, I think it is a significant thing that the only civilization that has a real secular movement is a Hebraic Christian civilization for two reasons. One part of the secularism came from the Greek component, the idea that nature's rational, that you can analyze it, that nature's not God, that you can thrust impious hands into nature. This was a part of the Greek component. But the other thing is very valuable for those of us who are religious, and that is that you needed a secular protest against false religious absolutes. For even a religion that worships the transcendent God who judges all men always is in danger of identifying its cause with his God. This is what distinguishes us from Islam, I think, for instance. At any rate, you have all these various forms of Christianity. You have Judaism, you have secularized Judaism, and you have secularism. I don't think that any of these have the absolute truth. And I thank God for the mixtum compositum of Western civilization, and I reject the idea that what is the matter with us is that we have to have an overarching faith.
Well, now that is a statement of what Western beliefs are. Professor Frankel, I'm going to ask you a slightly different question. You have written that the demand for a faith or a cause is an insistent feature of the present social scene. It presents the contemporary social philosopher with his opportunity and his test. So this is your opportunity and your test. What should our cause and faith be?
You mean in 1 hour with Mr. Toynbee and Mr. Niebuhr here to interrupt? That's going to be very difficult.
But I should like, first of all, to stress something that I think Mr. Niebuhr left out. I don't know whether he would wish to leave it out, but it seems to me very important when one looks at the beliefs on which modern Western culture turns. This is science. Nowhere except for a brief reference to Greek science did I hear Mr. Niebuhr mention what science and its, illegitimate child, technology, has done to the modern Western world. I think that when you look at what the scientific outlook has done in the West, even to those who know very little about science, it has done this. It seems to me to have encouraged people to ask for results. It has encouraged people to be just a bit doubtful about appeals to past authority, appeals to history, appeals to great swinging abstractions like liberty, justice, and all the rest. It has encouraged people to say, what does this mean in the day-to-day life of my community, in the day-to-day quality of my own personal experience? From this point of view, I think we ought to look at ideologies with a great deal of suspicion. We cannot compete with the Russians on the level of slogans. We have got to make changes in our own way of life. Now, what are the changes? Well, briefly, I would say this, that I think we live in a very rapidly expanding technological world. It's a revolution unlike any revolution in the past. It threatens the survival of the race on one side. It promises extraordinary joys and extraordinary enrichment of human experience on the other. If only we seize it, if only we stop pronouncing dirges about the good old days, which in fact never were. What does this technological revolution threaten? It threatens, it seems to me, the isolation of the individual, putting the individual in a position where, with all the slogans about freedom and everything else, he isn't really in control of his life. What we have got to do, it seems to me, is find social programs that will get individuals intimately involved in important things in their own neighborhoods, in their own local communities. We've got to find ways of restoring some texture to modern life.
Professor Toynbee, would you comment on those two statements and add your own?
I agree with both. And I think
so do I.
I think I see a thread between the Hebrew prophets, whom Dr. Niebuhr started with, and Dr. Frankel's pursuit of truth. Because I think science and the prophets both agree in self-criticism. After all, what is science and how could it make one move forward if it wasn't constantly full of humility and criticizing its own results and prepared to change them? The West, thanks to its science and technology, has become top dog in the world, and we've had this quite unnatural position in the world for the last two or three centuries, in which rather small minority of the human race, just the people of Western Europe and North America, have been dominant, and at the present moment we see this domination passing from us. And why? Because the things that have distinguished us during these last few centuries aren't our monopoly, they're just general human things. And so I would say the great challenge to us comes not particularly from Russia or the Soviet Union, though that's very external, the Sputnik and all that. It comes from inside ourselves. We are the people who've created this, fired this shot that's been heard around the world in the last two or three centuries. We're the people who've turned the world upside down. We Westerners are now getting the what they call feedback or backwash of this immense dynamic movement we've sent sweeping over the world. It's taken all sorts of funny forms. Communism, we don't like it, but that's a Western product and Western export. So is Nazism, so is democracy, fascism, nationalism, all these things. They're Western in origin, and now they're coming back on us, and we have to think what we feel about them. But above all, we have to be critical of ourselves. We're a minority, and when the rest of the world is going to get even with us in technology, we shall be very much aware of being a minority.
Well, now, you've listed some things that we believe in, some things we ought to believe in. Taking all these things together, is there any emotional content to them? Whether we like it or not, we are in competition with the Russians. They have an ideology which does tend to stir some people. It's enabled them to create branch offices in many countries, enabled them to win revolutions. Do we have any quality like that in our beliefs?
Oh, I think, Mr. Smith, I would point out first that the Russians have gone into other countries with the slogans freedom, equality, yeah, fraternity, science, human, yeah, brotherhood.
Yeah.
These are obviously moving terms. One of the worst things the Russians have done, I suppose, has been to corrupt the language, to destroy any vocabulary in which you can honestly and sincerely express your ideals, because they've all been besmirched by being taken over by the Russians. I think what turns people against us is the extraordinary disparity between our language and our actions.
Yeah. Yeah.
And here, I think, what we must export is not more propaganda, but a sense in the United States that we are really going someplace, that life amounts to more than a quick ride from one subtopia to another.
Could you give an example of what you were talking about when you said we should make our acts closer to our stated beliefs?
Well, there are the obvious ones, like our own colonial problem, namely the problem of the South and the racial problem. I'm sure many of you have been abroad will know from your own experience how extraordinarily sensitive people in Western Europe are to any statement by an American about their colonial problems. They think we have one right immediately at home, and I thoroughly agree. But assuming that we do try hard, and Scott Fitzgerald once said that about the United States, I think it's very true. You can say anything you want against the United States, said Fitzgerald, but by God, we try. And that is about my feeling. We do try. And I wish that sometimes that we not only tried hard, but had some definite goals in mind.
Well, another feature that the communist ideology has is it explains history. It penetrates the mysteries for people, where they've been, where they stand now, and what they can expect in the future. Is there anything like that in our set of beliefs? Professor Toynbee.
I suppose we're much less dogmatic, and we don't think we got one key that explains it all.
I would have assumed, though, Professor Toynbee, I say this in all modesty, yeah, that you thought you had just a little bit of a key to explain it all. You mean we don't? I agree that many of us don't think we do, but do you think there is such a key?
I think looking into the past, you can see certain shapes and patterns in history, but I don't think you can predict the future, and I certainly wouldn't like to put anyone to death on the strength of my beliefs about history.
History,
well,
that's good for me.
History is a series of emergences and emergencies which are not predictable. And I think Professor Toynbee says himself, he tries to learn out of history, as we all must, but we can't predict history. That shows that the historical sciences aren't like the natural sciences.
Well,
I'd like to...
I don't want to...
Go ahead.
take up what Mr. Frankel's about Russian hypocrisy and the distortion of the meaning of words. On the principle of the parable of the mote and the beam, isn't there a good deal of hypocrisy and distortion of words on our side? This phrase, the free world, doesn't it ever stink in our nostrils now when we see all the...
Professor Toynbee, yeah. Don't you have to have some means of language to distinguish between nations like ours, where you have liberal institutions, civil rights like freedom of speech, assembly, and thought, and a real choice at election time, to distinguish that world from the communist world where those things don't prevail?
Well, I've been more modest in my phrase, I think. When I tot up all the unfree things on our side of the line, it makes me quail, really.
Suppose we settle for the comparatively free world.
Of the world.
Well, I would like to ask...
I think I would say the free world, or comparatively free. While I agree with Mr. Toynbee, it seems to me simply extraordinary, given human failings, the tendency of any one of us to take himself terribly seriously and to be something of a fanatic, that we in the West have maintained institutions that grant civil liberty, recognize respect dissent. When we come to admire dissent, we'll be doing even better. But even that we respect dissent seems to me an extraordinary achievement for an animal that, after all, is pretty close to the ground and that has only been civilized 6,000 years. You know, that's nothing. That's a postage stamp on top of
that sounds like the
Earth.
Idea of progress.
Oh, I believe in progress. I think that we oughtn't to pull back from the extraordinary achievements of the modern world. And one of them are these free institutions. They're not free enough. But I think we ought to take pride in what we have done well, just to be jolly sure that we keep that as we go ahead.
I would like to carry that point just a little further and quote from Professor Toynbee's 9th volume. In that, sir, you said, the negative liberal ideal of civil liberty for individual men and women was as ineffective a weapon as an unstrung crossbow to pit against the positive communist ideal of a self-sacrificing devotion to the service of collective humanity. The grandeur of the communist ideal made the liberal ideal look trivial. Could you comment on that and expand on that?
Yes, I said that this rather superficial belief in individual liberty depends on an unspoken, perhaps forgotten belief which goes back to Christianity and Judaism. It really has a kind of religious foundation. I'm inclined to believe that there are a kind of unspoken religious principles underneath that belief, and that the communist challenge to the belief in individual liberty is going to force us to bring out in our own minds what it is that really makes us have this feeling that we do have.
Let me add a little something to that that may not be quite in agreement, and that is I don't think it's purely individual liberty, but it's a free society in which the various functions and powers can countervail each other. What makes communism bad, however good its dream is that it establishes a monopoly of power.
Yes.
And that is a source of injustice, even though it claims to have justice.
Yes.
Because without an equilibrium of power, you can't have justice. Any kind of monopoly of power makes for injustice. This is, I think, what we have to say between us and the communists. Now, you can't get as much emotion about this. This is one feels that Western civilization requires a great deal of maturity. That's why I'm not quite confident that we will prevail in Asia and Africa, in the new nations. I think it requires too much maturity, but that may be too fetus.
I think we always run into trouble, particularly because we carry our past on our backs. We're white, we're Christian, and it's the white Christians who in the recent past have been the imperialists.
Yes.
Only in the recent past. We have got to be terribly careful not to present this to other people in the world as a Western thing. And I don't think it is, you know. I think despite what the Indians say sometimes about being above physical comforts, everybody wants physical comfort. And I, by the way, think that we have been saying some rather silly things in the United States in an effort to show we're not materialistic against physical comfort. I think physical comfort is generally good for the spirit. I think poverty is bad for its spiritual consequences.
In listing the elements that you think that our faith should include, Professor Toynbee and Dr. Niebuhr have both put religion very high on the list, but Dr. Frankel has not mentioned it. Do you feel that religion is a necessary part of our beliefs?
Well, I think it's that's like asking whether the state is or oxygen is.
I mean formal religion.
Yes, formal religion seems to me to be with the human race for the foreseeable future, like oxygen. The real question about oxygen is not whether we can live without it, but is it pure or impure? And the real question about religion is the same.
Yeah.
And here I think I'm not too far apart from both Mr. Toynbee and Mr. Niebuhr, although I suspect I would see certain impurities in some parts of religion where they don't, and perhaps vice versa. Yeah. There has been as much spiritual energy, love of truth, religious dedication in the world of science and independent philosophy in the modern world as the same qualities that went into the building of medieval cathedrals. I wish we weren't constantly taking ourselves down. Live with any scientist who's really dedicated, or any scholar, and you will see there a belief which most of our religions have cheapened. And that is the belief that there is an independent structure of things that is what it is, no matter what we hope, no matter what we desire, and that it's incumbent upon us to conform our ways of thinking and behaving to that independent structure. We didn't make the world. We live before a larger order of things, and we must fit in. Now, that is, I think, what religion at its best stands for, but it is what science stands for. And constantly to set the two against each other is what sets my teeth on edge.
I would take that difference.
I would agree with that.
I'd accept that definition of religion, but it has a consequence.
I didn't know I had to find it, but go ahead.
Practical consequence. That is humility, isn't it? Man isn't lord of the universe, is what you're really saying. And humility is as necessary in science as it is in
my suspicions of religion is that it seems to me, on the whole, arrogance is a human trait, but it seems to me religion has made a trade union for it very frequently.
Yes, I agree. Yeah.
I would like to change the subject briefly. Unless there are any further comments on that. Does Western faith involve commitment to a definite economic system? That is free enterprise an integral part of our beliefs?
Could I say something about that? I think that one of the great advantages of a democratic society is that it dissolves the two dogmas of right and left by which Western society almost was shipwrecked, the collectivists and the individualist free enterprise. Both of these were dogmas. Now it is a significant thing that the healthy societies, the Anglo-Saxon societies, the Scandinavian, Western European societies, our society, we've all got a mixed economy.
Yeah.
We've all got some kind of a welfare state, whether we call ourselves capitalists or socialists. We got a welfare state. What does this mean? Well, on the one hand, you have enough control to prevent the weak from being absolutely exploited by the strong, and on the other hand, you prevent and you allow place for initiative and freedom.
I think this is very important, and partly brings me back to question that Ms. Toynbee and Ms. Smith both touched on. This is another very good example of bringing our actions and our words closer together. Einstein once said about the scientists, if you want to understand science, don't listen to what scientists say, look at what they do.
Yeah.
And if you want to understand the United States particularly, probably the worst way is to listen to what we say, because our words are usually worse than our actions. It really isn't a question of living up to our professions. It's sometimes a case of bringing our professions into closer accord with our achievements.
I would like to ask you now, is nationalism a necessary part of our beliefs? Nationalism is one of the most powerful forces in the underdeveloped world today. At the same time, it's been suggested that in our developed part of the world, nationalism's out of date and we should seek some higher allegiance. Hmm. What do you think about that?
I'm utterly against nationalism. I think we invented it. It's one of the most calamitous exports from the West to the rest of the world. But we're going through a long period in which people who've been under foreign rule are going to react nationalistically against it. It's the key to the Arabs' feeling, it's the key to the Chinese feeling present, it's the key to the whole feeling in Asia and Africa. To a certain extent in the Russian feeling too, because they've been inferior compared to the West in the past.
Dr. Niebuhr?
I'd have a slightly different answer to that. I'd say you can't be against nationalism any more than you can be against the individual, because nationalism is collective individualism. And Professor Toynbee is quite right. Much of this nationalism is a protest against older forms of imperialism. The most ironic fact of present history is that the two supernations are both anti-imperialistic by definition. And of the two of them, Russia is the only real empire since the classical empires, because it has a universal ideology that gives you... And we are an empire that desperately tries not to be. And here I challenge Professor Toynbee's concept of equality a little bit. I, of course, equality is a principle of justice. But instead of being afraid that we might be unequal, we ought to recognize that we've got great power, and we've got to make a responsible use of that power.
We have very little time left. May I ask you just one more question? Does the fact of juvenile delinquency, which is growing constantly and is huge at present, indicate that there is some failing in the faiths of the Western world? We're failing to fill something in the minds of young people?
France and Italy are said to be the countries where it's not so bad, and there the family is rather strong, isn't it? Is it something to do with the structure of the family, the changes in the loosening in the bonds of the family? I don't know, but...
But I would say, Mr. Smith, that if you read a book like Leckie's History of Morals, for example, you will find extraordinary descriptions of juvenile delinquency in other ages. Friends of mine who have traveled to Russia have come back and report that there are conferences in Moscow on juvenile delinquency. The growth in it may simply be a growth in our sensitivity to the phenomenon. More statistics, more worry about it. What we sometimes take to be moral decline is simply growth in moral sensitivity to evils. We therefore note the evils.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt you at this stage and to try to sum up some of the things that you've said. Dr. Niebuhr said that the West has no integrated single system of beliefs like the set of beliefs our opponents have under the name of Marxism, the monolithic philosophy. Dr. Frankl said that the faith of the West should include many qualities. It should contain a skeptical, questioning, scientific attitude. It should stand for concrete changes in ways of life rather than absolute and ultimate things. Professor Toynbee went further and said the West's future may hang on its capacity to criticize itself. The challenge we face, and I think this is probably one of the profound truths of our time, is not from outside, from Russia, it is from inside ourselves. No enemy can defeat us, but we can defeat ourselves. What turns people against us frequently, it has been said, is a failure to fulfill our own credos. We try hard, it was said, but frequently we have no definite goals in mind. I think we can conclude with the remark made by Dr. Frankl that Americans do much better than they say. I hope in the future we find some way of expressing what we do better than we have in the past. With that, I thank you very much, and thank you. Good evening.
You have been listening to The Great Challenge, the last of seven special symposiums dealing with critical issues facing the American people. Today's program considered the question, what beliefs sustain the free world? Our guests were world-famed historian Arnold J. Toynbee, noted theologian and author Dr. Reinhold Niebuhr, and Professor Charles Frankl of Columbia University. Howard K. Smith of CBS News was moderator. This has been another broadcast in the public interest from CBS News. Only a network like the CBS Radio Network can present this kind of service. Only a station affiliated with CBS Radio can bring it to you. The Great Challenge was produced by James F. Fleming, associate producer Richard Simonofsky. This was a presentation of CBS News. Has recession talk been getting you down? Then it's time you took a look into the future, your future and the future of America. Get all the exciting and encouraging facts. Drop a card today for the free booklet, Your Great Future in a Growing America. The address is Box 1776, Grand Central Station, New York 17. This is the CBS Radio Network.